Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States responding to the budget address by the President. Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elvey.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And I'm Andrea Seabrook.
We have a special guest with us this week, the irrepressible, effervescent Andrea Seabrook.
Am I in the right studio? Sorry.
We are so glad to have you with us to talk about the big news of the week. Andrea, the budget.
The budget. You mean...
Any budget.
Which one are you talking about? Because there's so many budgets.
All right. We've got a budget for 2011, the current budget year. We've got a budget proposal for 2012.
Yes.
And many, many, many years on beyond, decades beyond. I appreciate you always making that point.
Well, let me stop... Let me say something here. And this is something that people out in radio land need to remember. The 2011, the rest of the year, fiscal year, yeah, we're going to cut the funding, whatever. When you make a budget proposal for the next year, though, you're really changing line items, you're moving projects around, you're closing whole programs. It's totally different. It's something that looks forward beyond just the next 6 months, how much the funding will be. So we've had this huge kerfuffle and angry yelling about how to fund the rest of the year when it seems so much less consequential than laying out your blueprint for 2012 and beyond.
Well, first, obviously, we had to go through that nonsense of getting through September 30th because nothing could be done until then.
Yeah.
But there were so many questions about, one, where was President Obama during this whole thing? And two, who won? I mean, basically, this podcast is not about to talk about what departments got cut, what, you know, how the funding of the government goes.
He always hated policy.
Well, this podcast is about politics and the perception of winners and losers.
I was going to suggest we do the entire podcast without any reference to dollar figures. What do you think of that? We could do it.
Yeah, well,
we could
what's fun to me is that, first of all, everybody was criticizing President Obama because he was not part of it. He was aloof. He was keeping his distance from everybody.
He was putting Joe Biden to sleep.
Well, as this podcast does.
Let me break in here and say, as the president loves to say, good policy is good politics. And I think that's what we saw. Oh, stop. God, guys, you're so... I think that's what we saw in the president's speech this week. I mean, I think you saw him retake the offensive by jumping into the water of cutting entitlements someplace that only the Republicans had dared go before.
Yes, and I know the Republicans found it offensive. This is really quite true, though. The president essentially used Paul Ryan as a blocker in football terms. Let him crash into the line with his Medicare plan, which, of course, has a lot of problems for Republicans as well as Democrats because it does seem to transfer a lot of the cost of seniors' medical care from the government to seniors.
No, it does.
And so using that as a blocker, then the president comes in and goes, well, you know, Paul Ryan's doing it all wrong, but truth is we do have to do some kind of tough things, people, not the way Paul Ryan would do it. But it still has to be kind of tough.
Yeah, he took the whole scrum on top of him. Paul Ryan did. I mean,
Ken, your thoughts?
Two things. First of all, back to the winners and losers. We said for the longest time that if you look at the way it is, we're already talking in Republican terms. We're talking about not how much more money we could spend, but how less money we could spend. And already they're in Republican arguments saying we're cutting billions, billions, and billions and trillions. However, while all the Democrats are saying, where's my president, where's Obama and all this, the fact is that he waited, as Ron just said, he waited for Paul Ryan to draw a line. And then, like, with The Price is Right, Obama could come just short of that and have everything to the left of that, which is a huge gap.
Huge gap.
Take the argument. And basically, he just drew the comparisons for 2012.
Well, sports in terms of analogies. We have moved lock, stock, and barrel into the Republicans' ballpark here. We are definitely talking about what has been their issue, and we're talking about it largely in their terms by cutting spending. We don't talk, by the way, anymore about cutting programs. There was a time when we used to talk about cutting programs. We never talk about that anymore.
Okay, but
it's all spending.
Fine, okay. The Republicans are winning the policy argument then. That's what you're making. They're not winning the politics this week, though.
Clearly. No, they're not winning the
politics.
They are
not winning the politics. And I have to say, when it comes down to November now of 2012, I can't believe we're already looking forward to that. I guess they are.
You don't listen to the podcast? We are focused on 2012.
Okay. Okay, but what matters when it comes down to that day in November of 2012 is the politics. Not the policy.
Okay, I'm going to write that down. It's the politics, not the policy. Andrea Seabrook, April 14th. Hey, it's April 14th. We've got to deal with the usual problem, which is that big votes are going to be taken in Congress today. And we're doing the podcast now. And
today,
in
you mean
theory,
Thursday?
We don't know what exactly is going to happen.
It's true.
But we know more than you would think.
Because we record every option. Is that what you're trying to say?
So, shall we explain how we knew that the CR was going to pass, but the 2012 budget resolution was not?
Sure.
All right. So, we believe that the CR will pass the 2011 budget, the thing that kept us from having a government shutdown last week. We believe that'll be approved, House and
Everyone
Senate.
Everyone is exhausted by it.
Okay, so it's going to pass, and the House and Senate are going to approve it. But the Paul Ryan plan, will that even come to a vote, I ask you, Andrea Seabrook?
There's almost no reason for it to come to a vote at this point.
Except, well, no, it's one big one.
Except the leadership has staked their reputation on it.
Yes. Is it not true that they were hoping to go home for this two-week recess around the Easter and Passover holidays and be able to say to their constituencies, we cut billions in 2011, and now we're cutting trillions for the decades to come thanks to the brilliance of Paul Ryan and his plan. Wasn't that the idea?
That was the idea. They certainly didn't want to go home for a two-week recess and then come back and vote on it. That's what happened to the Democrats over cap and trade, and it gave birth to the Tea Party town halls. I mean, going home and letting moderates and seniors stew for a couple weeks about how you're going to, you know, kill Medicare, which it really does change it fundamentally.
It changes it fundamentally.
Yeah.
They of course, say, Paul Ryan says, it saves Medicare, that because if there is not some way to shift costs in some fashion to get the government off the hook for all of these costs by 2050, that's going to be the budget, that and debt service.
Well, that's just complete semantics, because you can call it, you can just make it into a completely other program and keep calling it Medicare, but it's not what it was.
But wait a second. Wait, first of all, one, we don't think that Medicare, Medicaid is going to be the large portion of the budget problems. Of course it's a budget
problem. Yeah, absolutely.
And two, where was President Obama all this time when his budgets, at least the 2 years of his presidency, when his budgets were out of control, when record deficits were being, I mean, he suddenly basically become a born-again budget hawk.
Yeah, okay, but how many Democrats have run on saying, but they just raised the government, the spending of the government. They just put us in a deficit. They just, it doesn't matter.
You mean the Republicans during the period of George W. Bush's presidency?
Yeah, in other words, it doesn't matter when they come back and say, they stole the issue from us.
No, that does not matter.
It doesn't matter.
No, that doesn't matter. And Bill Clinton proved that again and again.
After the president's speech, there was a flood of emails into my inbox from angry Republicans saying, they stole our issue. He wasn't here before.
That's
a loser. Just doesn't matter.
Of course. We saw Ronald Reagan quoting FDR for a million years. We saw Democrats quoting Ronald Reagan for a long time.
And how many times did George W. Bush quote JFK and so forth?
The voters only hear what the issue is now and where people land on it when it comes to election.
The voters want to know how it's going to affect them. And we're moving on now to the Republicans having a huge target to attack, and that is taxes. The president and the Democrats are again talking about raising taxes on somebody. Now, they're going to insist that it's only going to be on a tiny little minority known as the wealthy, a tiny little minority known as the millionaires, a tiny little minority known as people who make $250,000 a year or more, which is not necessarily.
It's actually not that tiny.
That tiny.
Well, number,
and it's not just millions, millionaires, but it is a level to which many more Americans may aspire and may have reason to think they'll get to. Plus, we have a long-standing history of people believing that when taxes are going up, they're going up on them. It doesn't matter what the government says. It doesn't matter what the Democrats say. If taxes are going up on somebody, the average American figures it's going up.
Well, look at the polls of all these people who think that people are taxed too high when they're probably taxed lower than at any time for the most part in recent
Which
history.
Is not to say that it isn't still too high. I mean, where are our assumptions? Do we assume that all taxation levels up to now are justified, so anything that is lower than that is ultra-justified?
Though, didn't Bill Clinton raise taxes and we had economic growth?
1993.
And didn't George W. Bush lower taxes and we had economic decline? So, I mean, one is doesn't...
We didn't have an economic decline right after he raised taxes.
But
and there were a lot of other
factors.
But
I'm saying there was... well, yes, it was 9/11.
And the economy did well through much of the decade until it completely crashed.
Well, most economists say, though, it was the weakest recovery from after 9/11. It was the weakest recovery from a recession. Yes,
until this recovery.
One.
Okay.
So the tax cuts, we don't know if they necessarily did. But yes, they
I'm just saying it doesn't,
making your
I'm
point.
Just saying tax raises doesn't necessarily bode ill for the economy, and tax cuts doesn't necessarily bode well for the economy.
It's not a settled case,
right,
one way or another. It could, in fact, mean that the relative rate of taxation is not necessarily the biggest determinant of economic performance.
And a new boom sweeps clean.
I've never understood if anyone actually votes on the stuff you're talking about or not.
Well, that's what I was going to try to pull it back to. I was going to try to pull it back to, isn't it more important what voters think than what is, in fact, the policy result?
Sure.
So
but
what
I'm
do we
sure
know about how voters think?
I mean, I'm not sure they even think, oh, I think we should lower taxes because it creates... I don't think they... It really depends on these huge macroeconomic ideas in the first place. I mean, I think it's more about, am I going to get cut? Is my child going to be able to go to a good school? You know, it's these much closer to home issues when it comes down to the day. And, you know, as most pundits said after this election, we can say it was all about the deficit as a, or whatever, the debt, all these arguments the Republicans made. What it was about
was jobs.
It was about where the economy was on November 2nd. It wasn't about
anything.
Okay,
let's take a little informal poll. What was it about? Was it about jobs?
Jobs.
Girls. What's going on?
Okay, let's talk about the... Okay, I need to say something. The take-home message this week about the Republican Party. And I said it on Morning Edition this week, and that was, I have never seen the Republican Party look so much like the Democratic Party. They're fractionalized. They're fighting each other through the press. They voted for leaders that a lot of them don't support, at least the ones who just gave them the majority. They're anti-institutional, but voted for institutional
leaders.
But,
Andrea, but who are the adults here? Are the adults the Tea Party folks who will vote against the debt limit regardless of the consequences, or are the adults the people who are trying to work out some kind of a deal to keep the government running?
I don't care who the adults are. They're just acting so much less like
disciplined,
the
organized party
they are.
What fascinates me is...
Isn't that the inevitable result of getting the majority? When any party gets the majority, then it is possible for all of its various factions to contend for control.
No, I think this is special. I think this is different. If the Tea Party were a separate party itself and we had some kind of parliamentary thing, then they would be some kind of crazy coalition between the Tea Party and the Republican Party. There are two parties in one right now.
All right. But that's what, in a sense, we have. And it's the Republicans who have chosen all the leaders.
Yeah.
They didn't even let Michelle Bachmann come into the little clubhouse to have some minor little goofy title. They didn't want her in there at all.
What fascinates me about this whole thing is that many on the progressive left are saying that President Obama gave away the store, the Democrats gave away the store, and yet the Tea Party folks are saying, well, Boehner should be primaried in 2012. They should be a primary against Eric Cantor because
he should be challenged as
they sold out. They didn't do enough. Now, you know how everybody says that they think NPR is too liberal or too conservative, and therefore we know we're doing something right. You know, we always do that comment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you think that if the left was so unhappy and the right was so unhappy with this budget compromise, maybe the right thing did happen.
The shutdown aversion.
Well, I'll tell you, if there were the ability for a moderate caucus to come together with the moderates in the two parties and they could drive this house down the middle of the road, America would be so lovingly
and
happy,
would,
and it's never going to happen.
And they would, because they would all
the
be defeated in the next primary.
Exactly.
In the next primary.
Well, isn't this what's happening in the Senate, though, with the Gang of Six? Isn't that the idea of the Gang of Six?
It is.
Three Republicans, three Democrats, all of them interested in the budget issue, all of them with some credibility on the budget issue, several of them former members of the Bowles and Simpson Commission. These are guys getting together and saying, we're Republicans, we're Democrats, we differ on all the issues, but we really think this budget issue needs to be resolved in a sensible way.
You know what I'd like to know? How many of them have closed party primaries? Because
a lot of them are also leaving. I mean, you have the Kent Conrads of the world who are also running away, you know, leaving town.
But that's only one out of this.
But it's the closed party primaries that are doing this, too.
I think you're probably right. Plus, it is also in the House where you, through redistricting, have created these hyper-Democratic districts and hyper-Republican districts.
Totally.
So that you have to be the most Republican person in the entire district to get to represent it in Congress, or the most hyper-Democratic person in the district to go the other way.
The fact that Dick Lugar is a liberal sellout, I mean, anybody who watches
a liberal sellout, Dick
Lugar. And the
Orrin Hatch.
The problem that the Republicans are going to have keeping the House is the same problem the Democrats had in keeping the House, and that is those districts that aren't 60% to 80% one party or the other. It's those swing districts. How are they going to keep those swing districts if they vote against the debt ceiling? How are they going to keep those swing districts if they don't compromise to just keep the government running, for God's sakes?
What was Senator Barack Obama's argument for voting against the debt ceiling when he was a senator? What was his argument?
In 2006?
Yeah,
they raised the debt ceiling, and of course the Republicans were in the majority in the House and the Senate, so they had to provide the majority of the votes. And showboaters, and Barack Obama was definitely showboating in 2006 when he did this. The White House has acknowledged it was a mistake. They haven't quite called it what it was, but he was trying to get the attention of people on the left in the Democratic Party because he wanted to run for president starting in 2007. This was one of his opening shots of his campaign, and he went out and said, I'm too pure to vote for this. And it's the president and his party's fault that we have this big debt and this deficit, and I want to see a plan for bringing the debt down before I will vote for this.
Okay, so which is exactly what you're hearing from conservative Republicans now. I am not going to vote to extend the raise the debt limit until spending comes down. So why are the Tea Party people so extremist, and why was Barack Obama not an extremist when it's basically the same position?
Well, and let's say that Barack Obama's speech this week basically said the same thing, though. I mean, the target dates that he gave and the timeline for his, you know, bringing down the budget proposal, they go right along with the dates that the government will run out of money to pay for debt service.
That is why the White House's response to this would be the difference is George W. Bush never brought out a plan like the one President Obama suggested this week.
Yes, but what was remind me again, the 2011 budget that the Democrats came up with last year?
They did not.
Right. Exactly.
They had no such thing.
Exactly.
Wait,
they had no
such thing. Let me answer your question, and that is there was no chance of anyone voting down raising the debt limit then. So you could showboat. I mean, you could say no. But now there is a chance that there aren't enough Republicans to raise the debt ceiling.
That's a good point.
And so you can't, I mean, to showboat is a totally different responsibility.
The economic climate in this country is far
different.
Right, it's totally
different.
Because
we had the collapse of 2007-8.
Right.
And we really do know what it feels like to see everything in free fall, and the stock market's in free fall, and the banks not necessarily opening up in the morning.
And it affects the little guy.
One more thing about the budget that, look, obviously President Obama is trying to take the high road or at least compare himself favorably to the Paul Ryan. But in talking about cutbacks, he's talking about a $400 billion cut. Over 10 years in the Pentagon, which is twice as much as Secretary Gates is willing to consider, given the fact that we're in two, perhaps three wars. So there may be some disunity in the administration on that.
And let's not forget that there is one giant difference between the president's budget that he laid out in the speech and Paul Ryan's budget. They both cut about the same amount of money. It's funny, over time, $4 trillion.
Yeah.
But Paul Ryan makes the tax cuts for the Bush 01 and 03 tax cuts permanent, and therefore he has to cut a lot more in spending to pay for those permanent tax cuts over time.
Well, it has to go to Medicare and Medicaid.
So it's funny that they save the same amount of money, but Paul Ryan has to cut a lot more in order to save the same amount of money.
Well, he's not only making those tax cuts permanent, but he's also lowering the individual and business rate all the way down to 25%.
But President Obama said he will refuse to consider extending the Bush tax cuts beyond 2012, but that's what he said when he first came into office, too.
He was pretty clear. I refuse to do it, not while I'm president. He said, I won't do it again.
Okay, well, we'll see if he means it this time. We've got a few other things to cover. I'd just like to say Ken and I are incredibly grateful that you joined us today. Andrea Seabrook, thank you for all your excellent reporting on this issue all week, and we'll hope to have you on again in future podcasts.
It is my pleasure, Ron Elving, and let me just say,
bye, Andrea.
Okay, on less interesting subjects, Mitt Romney is exploring. What is he exploring, Ken?
He is the ostensible, and we keep using this word, and I wish we wouldn't use this word.
Ostensible?
He's the ostensible front runner for the Republican nomination for 2012. And obviously, I don't know why, because he doesn't look like he's doing any better in the poll than, for example, Mike Huckabee, who
Donald
may not
Trump.
Even be running.
Or Donald Trump.
Explain that to me.
We're going to get there.
Okay.
All right. These are the official things. Mitt is exploring.
Right.
Rick Santorum has a testing the waters
committee. No, I think he also
explored.
He's also exploring.
Oh, is he exploring?
Yeah, exploring as well.
All right. So when we stop testing the waters, we begin to explore. This is a little bit like Columbus. He tests the waters, and then when he gets someplace
It's not really Columbus. It's more Cincinnati.
All right. So Mitt's exploring. Santorum is also exploring. But the person everybody's talking about right now in the blog sphere and on the cable networks and so on is Donald Trump.
Now, we explained this last week in the podcast, saying that, of course, name identification and self-promotion, which is Donald Trump's hallmark.
Oh, I thought we were explaining the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, what a lot of people like to do is, here's proof that the Republicans are in big trouble for 2012 because Donald Trump seemed to lead the field. But we said this last time, it was Jesse Jackson, it was Gary Hart, it was other people who may have been embarrassed for things they've done, but because everybody knew who they were leading in the polls.
I think
as we get closer to Iowa, New Hampshire, Donald Trump is not going to be leading anything, and for all we know, he won't ultimately run. But, I mean, you see a lot of people like Marco Rubio saying that by focusing on the birth issue, Donald Trump is doing doing a disservice to the Republican Party.
But in the meantime, we expect him to announce his plans on the finale of Celebrity Apprentice. Now, a lot of people have been saying all this is about is trying to boost the ratings on Celebrity Apprentice.
Which is actually a very popular show.
It has worked, but it has raised the ratings quite a bit. So is he going to announce that he's running, or would it work just as well for his purposes to announce he's not?
I think you're right.
Thank you. All right. So moving right along. Now, among this is a big Republican field or non-field, however you want to think about it, but there's roughly a dozen names being bandied about. Another one, of course, is Tim Pawlenty, the former governor of Minnesota, seen as kind of a moderate option, although he's running right now very hard to please conservatives. He was out there saying that this compromise by which the government was kept open was a bad deal and Republicans shouldn't like it. And so is Michelle Bachmann, another person from Minnesota that very few people expected to see in the presidential field, but running currently in the Sarah Palin lane. What are they thinking opposing a deal to keep the government open?
They are thinking that the rank and file in the Republican Party, the strong social conservatives who make up the majority of the caucus goers in Iowa, they probably are in tune with them, saying that it doesn't cut enough and it's just, you know, too much spending on social programs. And I think they are looking at the Iowa caucuses more than anything else, and they know where that social conservatives, fiscal conservatives, make up a majority of the vote there.
And Michelle Bachmann said that she would not vote for any compromise, even if it meant shutting the government down, unless it defunded Obamacare, as she calls it.
And this is true Tea Party philosophy. I mean, this is basically what gave the Republicans the majority in 2010, the opposition to the Obama health care plan and the opposition to the growing federal government spending plans. And Pawlenty and Bachmann represent that view.
Interestingly, Haley Barbour, the governor of Mississippi, was in New Hampshire, and he was asked for his reaction to the deal. And he said, well, it's a single in the first inning, but Boehner got what he could get, and we're going to move on to make bigger cuts in the future. Almost more of a pro-Congress kind of view.
Well, but probably a pro-establishment kind of view, and that is Haley Barbour. Haley Barbour, if you remember him as RNC chair in the early 90s, Haley Barbour is the kind of guy who's not, he's never been a bomb thrower. He's an establishment kind of guy. He's very conservative, but he also knows the party inside and out.
He's also a Washington insider, having been a lobbyist here for a number of years when he wasn't in Mississippi.
And being a lobbyist is somebody who knows that you have to give a little to get something, and I think ultimately he probably feels that he, you know, was it a perfect for him? No. Was it perfect for the Republicans? No. But as he says, it's still the first inning.
And speaking of small ball, that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And I'm Andrea Seabrook.
Wait, who is that?
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
I keep hearing voices.